From NPR News, this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday, and I'm Joe Palca. The name Fritz Haber may not ring a bell, but his chemical inventions, both good and evil, are part of our modern-day life. In 1918, Haber won the Nobel Prize for developing a process to make ammonia. His discoveries led to nitrogen-based fertilizers, which improved crop production to feed the world's exploding population. However, his legacy is tainted. Haber also played a key role in developing poison gas as a weapon of war. What can we learn from the life of a man who created chemical warfare? Well, Dan Charles can help answer that question. Dan has just written a biography entitled Mastermind, The Rise and Fall of Fritz Haber, the Nobel Laureate Who Launched the Age of Chemical Warfare, published by Echo. He's also a contributing correspondent on the science desk of NPR. So we've known each other for a while. He joins me today from NPR studios in Washington. Welcome, Dan.
It's nice to be here, Joe.
So, Dan, Fritz Haber, first of all, who was he?
I call him the patron saint of guns and butter. He's the man who invented the chemistry that puts food on our table, even more so as the years go by. He's also the scientist who married science to war fighting more than any scientist had ever done before. And then at the end of his life, he was driven into obscurity so that today few people know about him.
So, well, let's start with his great accomplishment. Although even that has its downside, as you mentioned in the book, this ability to fertilize soil and make it far more productive by adding nitrogen back to the soil.
This is something that people... Sorry, did I interrupt the question?
No, go ahead.
This is something that people have been looking for with, I wouldn't say desperation, but with great intensity in the early days of the 20th century. There had been talk about food production leveling off as populations grew and mass starvation ensuing. Haber, in one way, was just lucky. He had access to some equipment from an industrial partner that turned out to be crucial. He also benefited from a fierce personal rivalry with his nemesis, Walter Nernst, whom he really couldn't stand. And Nernst insulted him at various points along the way and made Haber, who...
Nothing like an enemy to spur you along, yeah?
He had a strain of insecurity, and once that got activated, he worked incredibly hard. And he also had some very good collaborators who were solved some of the engineering problems. So it was more of an engineering accomplishment in many ways than a great theoretical breakthrough of the sort that we know from Einstein or Niels Bohr or famous scientists like that. But that was the kind of intelligence that Fritz Haber had. He was an incredibly vigorous and sharp-witted organizer. He was in many ways like Robert Oppenheimer, the father of the atom bomb. Oppenheimer, like Haber, was never known for great theoretical breakthroughs, great insights into the nature of the world. But they both organized teams of scientists to solve incredibly complicated problems like none of their contemporaries.
We're talking with Dan Charles about his new book, Mastermind, The Rise and Fall of Fritz Haber, and you're welcome to join the conversation. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. So he accomplished this, I suppose, as a practical person then when the leaders of Germany came to him in the early part of the second decade of the last century and said, we need some clever... Well, first of all, they said we need material to make gunpowder, but they also said to him, we'd like to come up with some good weapons. What do you got for us?
It was even more than that. I mean, Haber, when the war broke out, he threw himself into the war effort with enthusiasm and dedication. He, on his own initiative, really pushed forward a lot of two things, really. One is, you know, for all the accomplishments of the nitrogen capturing process for fertilizer, its first really large-scale use was to supply the German military with nitrate for explosives that kept them in the war. Germany would have been out of the war by the end of 1915 had it not been for Haber's process. And parenthetically, that would have been a very good thing for humanity. I mean, if the war had been over in 19... Yeah, if we might never have heard the words Hitler or Stalin if the war had ended in 1915. But he also got interested in this problem of using poison gas. The war was at a stalemate. Soldiers were in trenches. They were entrenched. There's a reason for that metaphor. And Haber had the idea gas could drive them out of trenches, could end the war, could make possible a breakthrough. His solution was the first generation of poison gas weapons was to blow chlorine gas and let the wind carry it toward the trenches. And that was what they did in the first chemical gas attack in April of 1915.
Wow. And so in a sense, he was a war hero from the German standpoint after World War I. And yet later in his life, he was utterly rejected by the German government. What was that? How did that come about?
Well, he was a hero to the German forces. He was also reviled in France and Britain to some extent. But here, so you're referring to the last year of his life. Haber comes out of the war. He's a prominent member of German society in the Weimar Republic between the First World War and heading, you know, into the Nazi takeover of power. Haber is also Jewish. He's part of that generation of German Jews who could integrate and play prominent roles in German society for the first time in history. He took advantage of that, but in 1933, when Hitler took power, that was it. Haber did not actually have to resign immediately. He was a war veteran from the First World War, so he didn't have to, but he did. He resigned in protest after trying to protect as many of the people in his institute as he could. And he spent the last year of his life wandering around, trying to find a place to land. You read his letters from that year of his life, and it's sort of a tragic story. A man, the principles of his life had been kind of turned upside down. His devotion to his country and his devotion to technological progress, he was trying to make sense of these things and never quite succeeded. He died a broken-hearted German patriot, you might say, and was buried in a cemetery adjoining the German border in Basel in Switzerland.
But I think it's important to make it clear that his mind really was considered to be among the top intellects of his age. I mean, he was cavorting with the great thinkers of the 20th century, Max Planck and Albert Einstein and people like that.
He and Einstein were good friends. They weren't the closest friends in the world, but they stayed in touch with each other. Actually, when Einstein first arrived in Berlin, Haber kind of took him under his wing.
Wow.
He'd pushed for for Einstein to be recruited to come to Berlin, and he sort of showed Einstein around, showed him how things worked. He was older than Einstein and more of the organizer, more of the politician, you might say. And actually, he got involved in Einstein's personal life. He negotiated some of the terms of the separation between Einstein and his wife. And when Einstein occasionally took refuge in Haber's villa, refuge from his disastrous marriage.
Complicated man. Well, let's invite our listeners to join in. Our number is 800-989-8255, and we have a call from Dan in Malvern, Pennsylvania. Dan, welcome to the program.
Hello?
Hello, Dan. Are you there?
Yes.
What's your question?
Well, I have sort of a comment. Unfortunately, Haber led agriculture down the wrong path. And using synthetic nitrogen, I feel, is one of the biggest problems that ever came along in modern agriculture. It has caused lots and lots of problems, and it can be done all by bacteria on it, with no energy input whatsoever to produce as much nitrogen as you need without subjecting the plant to huge amounts of synthetic nitrogen, which cause lots of disease and other problems.
Okay, well, Dan, in Malvern, Pennsylvania, Dan Charles in Washington, what do you make of that?
Well, that's an important point. The nitrogen fertilizer story is a complicated one, and it has a dark side. And there's no question that parts of the world are awash in nitrogen, basically from agriculture. Some people call it the other global change phenomenon, along with global warming. As the nitrogen it washes off the fields into the streams, into the estuaries, into places like the Chesapeake Bay, it changes ecosystems. It's a major source of pollution. At the same time, you know, you have to see the other side as well. There are other parts of the world that are desperately short of nitrogen, like much of Africa, where they really could use one way or another. It doesn't have to be the sort of the synthetic route. They really need more fertilizer. And then there's other parts of the world, like China, where by my reading of the situation, it was absolutely essential in the 1970s and the 1980s that the synthetic nitrogen actually be used on a large scale to keep food production flourishing there. So it's a complicated situation around the world, but it is very much true that nitrogen is one of the globe's great pollutants these days.
Yeah, and I suppose even if there's an up and a downside to, well, I don't know, maybe someone would argue there's an upside to figuring out how to use chemical weapons more efficiently or more effectively, but that one seems a little more weighted toward the negative, if you know what I mean.
Sure. Can I make one comment about that, though?
Of course, yeah.
For Haber, this was the cutting edge. This was the cutting edge of technology. And maybe it was good, maybe it was bad. He thought it was good, but it was certainly inevitable in his mind. So the only question was, are we going to keep in the lead? And I think, today chemical weapons are not considered the cutting edge of military technology. Other things are. But I think you can make a pretty good argument that the spirit of Fritz Haber's work, in terms of military innovation in technology, is alive and well, and it's not so much different, I would argue. Now, people will get upset at me probably for saying this, but I think it's not so much different from the way Fritz Haber saw things in World War I.
Huh. But you think that Fritz Haber did it without a social conscience, and yet one of his proteges, you might say, who left Germany and came to America, took a different approach when he was involved in a big project, right?
Well, I find this a very interesting and almost unknown tale. There was a man named James Franck who was a protege of Fritz Haber's. In fact, Franck was right there in the trenches with Fritz Haber in April 1915 when they unleashed the chlorine gas, that the advent of chemical warfare, you might say. James Franck stayed at Haber's side at the Institute in Berlin where they worked together. Franck was also Jewish. They resigned in protest together in 1933. Haber soon died, but James Franck emigrated to the United States, ended up in Chicago at the University of Chicago, was recruited into the Manhattan Project. Now, here's the interesting thing. When he was recruited to join America's atom bomb effort, he made a condition. As far as I know, he's the only scientist who extracted a price, in a sense, from the government for doing that. He said, I'll work on the Manhattan Project if you promise me that if it comes time to use the bomb, I will have the opportunity to talk to a senior member of the American government about what I think about that. And that's what happened in the spring and summer of 1945. James Franck met with senior members of the U.S. government. He also co-authored a report called the Franck Report, basically saying that the bomb should not be used. And they had a long series of reasons for this, among them that there would, it would spread to other countries, that there would be nuclear wars in the future.
Okay.
To me, Franck is learning the lessons of Fritz Haber's life.
Yeah. Okay, we're talking with Dan Charles about his new book, Mastermind, The Rise and Fall of Fritz Haber. I'm Joe Palka, and this is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. So there is a legacy there, it sounds like.
There is a huge legacy, and this is one of the things that attracted me to this man's life. I mean, he is kind of the symbol in the reality of his life. He exemplifies kind of the light and the dark sides of progress, really, of human knowledge, of science, its potential for lots of different things, depending how society chooses to use them, for creation, for destruction. And there's just so much drama in it as well. Things like, his wife taking her own life in the middle of World War I, 1 week after that first gas attack. It's just so full of dramatic possibility.
Well, let's take a call now from, how about Theo in Flagstaff, Arizona. Theo, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hi.
I was just wondering if Haber was ever married.
Well, that's interesting, because Dan was just saying something about his being married. Why? I'm curious, before I let Dan answer, why are you asking?
Because he negotiated the terms of Einstein's divorce, and I was wondering if he had any experience in the matter.
And so you're thinking of it as, was he scientifically prepared to do this? But maybe yes. Dan can answer. Very interesting.
He had two disastrous marriages. His first wife is actually a very interesting person herself. She was a chemist. She was the first woman to get a doctorate in chemistry from the university in Breslau. She married Haber. They had one child. Clara Imarvar was her name. And she wrote in 1909, just as Haber was on the brink of his Nobel Prize-winning success, she wrote this incredible letter of desolation about their domestic life to a friend of theirs. And in 1915, as I mentioned, after the first gas attack, she, one night, as after Haber had come back from the front, she, in the middle of the night, picked up his army-issued pistol and took her own life. Haber married a couple years later again. Both his wives were also Jewish. He forced the second one to convert to Christianity. The first one had done so before they got married.
He had converted to Christianity.
He had converted in his 20s. That's right. It was a step toward being more fully German. That was how he explained it to a friend later in life. And that second marriage, they had two children, a son and a daughter. Both of them are still alive, living in England. That marriage lasted about a decade, and then they were divorced as well.
Okay. Dan, 30 seconds. Do you like Haber, or do you find him repulsive?
Ah, good question.
25 seconds.
I don't like him. I don't like him, but I can't condemn him. I find him just incredibly interesting. I wouldn't want to live with him exactly. I think I would like to watch him, though.
Sounds like a fascinating man to know and to listen to, and maybe just a little scary, too.
Yeah.
Anyway, Dan Charles, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dan Charles is author of Mastermind, The Rise and Fall of Fritz Haber, the Nobel laureate who launched the age of chemical warfare, published by Echo. He's also a contributing correspondent on the science desk for NPR. This program is produced by Annette Heist and Corey Binns. Charles Bergquist is our director and web producer. Karen Vergoth is senior producer. If you'd like to write to us, please send your letters to Science Friday, 55 West 45th Street, 4th floor, New York, New York, 10036. For internet, you can email us, scifry@npr.org. Check out sciencefriday.com for more information and links to today's program. You can also listen to past editions of Science Friday online, or take them with you from the iTunes Music Store. And check out Science Friday's Kids Connection free curriculum materials for teaching science using Science Friday. Just click on the teacher's link on sciencefriday.com. Ira Flatow will be back next week. For NPR News in New York, I'm Joe Palca.